Call to order the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency for Tuesday, February 12th. To start off with, we are carrying over House Bill 2143 till Thursday, and we will be rescheduling House Bill 2429 to another time in the future, perhaps. With that caveat, I will now open up a work session for the possible introduction of committee measures.
Chair Hovey, I move the following LCEs be introduced as committee bills. LC 1398, dated 11-27-2012. LC 1441, dated 11-06-2012. LC 1444, dated 11-06-2012. LC 1513, dated 1-28-2013, LC 1816, dated 1-25-2013, LC 2938, dated 2-4-2013, LC 3173, dated 1-22-2013, LC 3447, dated 1-29-2013, LC 3580, dated 2-8-2013. LC 3647, dated 2-1-2013. LC 3657, dated 2-5-2013. And LC 1798, dated 10-11-2012.
Representative Lively moves the following LCs be introduced as committee bills. LC 1398, dated 11-27-2012. LC 1441, dated 11-6-2012. LC 1444, dated 11-6-2012. LC 1513, dated 1-28-2013. LC 1816, dated 1-25-2013. LC 2938, dated 2-4-2013. LC 3173, dated 1-22-2013. LC 3447, dated 1-29-2013. LC 3580, dated 2-8-2013. LC 3647, dated 2-1-2013. LC 3657, dated 2-5-2013. And LC 1798, dated 10-11-2012. Is there any discussion on the introduction? Is there any objection? If not, the measures read are introduced as committee bills. With that, I'm going to skip around just a tiny bit in the agenda. And so don't be surprised if your bill comes up first or last. House Bill 2513, I'm opening a public hearing. Or excuse me, 2531, dyslexic. And Bob, would you read us just a little introduction about House Bill 2531?
Happy to, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair and committee members, House Bill 2531 expands the definition of appraisal management company to include companies ordering appraisals not related to mortgage transactions. There is no revenue impact, and we have a fiscal statement issued.
Okay. Thank you. We have registered to speak to us about this, Lori Egan.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Welcome back to the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency.
Thank you. Thank you. Chair Hovey, members of the committee, my name is Lori Egan. I'm an Oregon State Certified Appraiser, Vice President of the National Association of Appraisers, and founder of one of Oregon's first appraisal management companies. Appraisal management companies are more commonly known as AMCs, and to save some syllables, that's the terminology I'm going to use today. Just a little history. In 2010, Oregon passed its first AMC registration law, and that law had a more encompassing definition of AMC. Due to the passage of the Dodd-Frank Act later that year, we had to make some changes to our AMC law. With that change, we used a definition of AMC based largely on the language in the Dodd-Frank Act. Unfortunately, that definition left an inadvertent loophole by only requiring registration of AMCs who request appraisals for loan origination purposes. A recent phenomenon across the country is the advent of companies who are requesting proprietary appraisal products for purposes other than loan origination, which in some cases do not comply with the uniform standards of professional appraisal practice. Important decisions are being made on these products. The decision to begin the foreclosure process on an Oregonian's home, for example. This bill simply closes the loophole, and these companies would be required to register just like they were in the original law. So I'd like to ask for your support of House Bill 2531, and I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Thank you, Ms. Egan. The first question is, do you see this largely as a housekeeping measure to
very much so.
Conform with the federal rules and laws that your industry is subject to?
Federal.
Thank you.
Yes.
Representative Kinney-Geyer.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm just wondering how many AMCs there are currently that fall within the current definition and how many new companies have formed as a result of the loophole in Oregon.
I'm probably not going to be able to give you an exact number of the number of AMCs registered in the state of Oregon. I'm going to estimate approximately 140. The number that would be impacted by this, there may be none within the state of Oregon. Mm-hmm. I believe that we will find that these are more national asset management companies.
Thank you. Further questions from the committee? Not seeing anything. Thank you for that very clear description of this bill, which I think is probably non-controversial.
I would think.
But we never know sometimes. So thank you very much, and you have a pleasant afternoon.
Thank you.
Is there anybody else that wished to testify on House Bill 2531? Seeing none, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2531. Committee, I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 2140.
Chair Hovey, I move House Bill 2531 to the floor with a due pass.
Excuse me. I didn't open a work session on that.
Oh, sorry.
So, I closed public hearing, and we just opened a work session on House Bill 2140. So
there we go.
Just switch.
Don't get in such a hurry. No?
Yeah, just switch the bill number for that, and we'll be good.
Okie dokie.
Sort of.
I ought to listen better, shouldn't I? Okay, 2140. No. Chair Hovey, I move House Bill 2140 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that the bill be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference.
Representative Lively moves House Bill 2140 to the floor with a due pass recommendation and that it be referred to the Committee on Ways and Means by prior reference. Is there discussion on this bill? And committee, if you remember, this was the bill about the discrete investments that I should have Bob. Why don't you go ahead and now, Bob, and give us a description of the bill to refresh the committee's memory.
Mr. Chair, House Bill 2140 allows investment of local government sinking funds, bond funds, or surplus funds in commingled investment pools established by the state treasurer for the investment of funds of a state agency or local government, declares emergency effective on passage. We have both the fiscal and revenue statements on this bill.
And for the record, we did receive testimony from Chris Fick from the League of Oregon Cities on House Bill 2140. And I believe that's in OLIS?
It is.
Okay, thank you. So I did, just for committee's information, I did speak with the treasurer's office about this bill to make myself a little more comfortable with their indeterminate fiscal report and much more comfortable because it does go to Ways and Means to really look at that fiscal much more closely than we need to. So with that, I felt comfortable moving this bill forward. So that's the reasoning I jumped into this particular bill right away. So I don't have anything else. Any other discussion or questions about the bill? Mm-hmm. Samantha, may we have a roll call vote?
Representative Vega Peterson?
Aye.
Representative Thatcher?
Excused.
Representative Smith?
Aye.
Representative Kinney-Geyer?
Aye.
Representative Johnson?
Aye.
Representative Doherty?
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson?
Aye.
Vice Chair Lively?
Aye.
Chair Holby?
Aye. House Bill 2140 has received required votes and is passed to the floor with the subsequent to Ways and Means. So, not to confuse matters much more, we will go back to the top, and I will open a public hearing on House Bill 2210. Bob, give us a brief description of House Bill 2210, please.
Yes, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, committee members, House Bill 2210 creates a professional service classification in state service. It directs the Personnel Division to identify positions for professional service and establish a salary plan and other policies relating to the professional service positions.
Thank you. And up first, we have Sarah Miller.
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my name is Sarah Miller, and I'm the Deputy Chief Operating Officer for State Government. With the Chair's permission, I'd like to invite Salvador Uranus to join me at the table. Salvador is an HR Director at the Department of Consumer and Business Services, and given that HR is not my specialty, I'm here to talk about the bill, but if the committee has specific questions, I'd feel more comfortable if he was at the table with me.
Welcome. And if you'd introduce yourself for the record.
My name is Sarah Miller. I'm the Deputy Chief Operating Officer for State Government. I work at the Department of Administrative Services, and I'm here to speak about House Bill 2210. House Bill 2210 creates an additional category of management service. So inside of the existing classification and compensation system, there are three existing categories. Supervisory management service is what you all would generally think of when you think of a manager. It's a person who has direct supervisory responsibilities of subordinate employees. There is management service confidential, which is a category that particularly relates to a set of folks who are mostly involved in the collective bargaining process, and so they exist in management service because of their role in collective bargaining. And then there is management service managerial, so folks who have the authority to formulate or carry out management decisions or who represent management's interests in implementing policy work. When we began to talk about implementation of House Bill 2020 and 4131, one of the things that was really clear was we spent a lot of time having conversations about defining definitions, what would be counted in the ratios. And we focused on management service supervisory because we were most interested in direct managers to subordinate employees. In doing that work, we looked at the utilization of the management classification. Those are job titles we call principal executive manager. And there are many levels of them. They go from principal executive manager A, I think, all the way to J. Your use of the different classifications depends a lot about the span of control that you have of management authority for. But agencies have used the PEM, Principal Executive Manager series, in a lot of cases to attract highly skilled technicians to do particular work, mostly because of the compensation associated with that classification series. And the best examples that I can give you are, like, inside the Oregon Health Authority, we have folks who are PhDs or MDs who are in principal executive manager positions because we need to put them in that classification to achieve compensation, but that they don't have any direct subordinate employees that they manage. And so when we were talking at the Enterprise Leadership Team, which you all heard me talk about last week, the Chief Operating Office's team of agency directors who support identification of issues in operations of state government, they said, you know, the PEM series would be used much more clearly if we had a classification that allowed for us to have advanced technical professional level skill set outside of the management series. Our existing classification system doesn't have that. House Bill 2210 was intended to be a more appropriate use of the management series classification for non-supervisory employees. So it would create a fourth category of management service, the professional category. That would allow us to accurately classify positions that are not management in nature, but require special knowledge, education, or training at a professional level. This classification would also align the state system with the Federal Fair Labor Standards Act in mirroring the federal law definitions of professionals. We know and understand that both SEIU and AFSCME have concerns with this bill as it was introduced, and we have been in discussions with them about those issues. I expect you'll hear from several of my counterparts on their concerns. Our plan and their commitment has been to meet together to talk about resolving those concerns, because our intention was not to hide supervisors, not to make the system more clear, but in fact to add an additional level of transparency by creating a classification that would make it clear to the folks that we need to hire to do specific jobs in state government outside of the management series. With that, I'm open for any questions.
Thank you. Questions? Representative Richardson.
Thank you, Ms. Chair. Sarah, thanks for this this bill and for bringing this forward. Will there be any change in compensation as a result of this additional class being added?
Chair Holby, Representative Richardson, as a not HR professional, I can't speak exactly to the process that we use in the establishment of new classifications, but in general, I believe that the intention is that the way we create all classification levels is you define particular class specs, you take those specs and evaluate them to marketplace, and then you set compensation as it relates there. And so certainly, if there were particular professional categories that needed to be created in certain job types, we would look to make those appropriately related to the market as compared to the total compensation system. It is not an attempt to create a high-wage, high-profile job classification. It's really an attempt to be more transparent about the skill sets of the people who do this work.
Let me pull up. So that was,
did I get it right?
That was yes, I think you said. I think you said that when we create this new classification, we will review those that are going into it to see whether or not the salary that they're getting paid is appropriate for the circumstances based on the criteria that you establish with a new classification, which means that this could have actually a substantial fiscal impact and could be a substantial change in the compensation rate, since you're not going to say we will transfer the people at the same rate of pay, but they'll have a different classification.
Chair Holby, Representative Richardson, yes, your interpretation of my answer is correct. As I hear you replay it back to me, I feel a little over my skis, so I'd like to check with my folks back at home. You know, certainly that's not the intent in which the bill was drafted. It may be an unintended consequence and may be part of the concern that labor wishes to discuss with us.
Thank you. Representative Vega Peterson.
Hi, thank you. Thank you, Chair. So do you have any estimate about how many employees would be affected by this new classification?
Chair Holby, Representative Vega Peterson, I don't have an estimate, predominantly because the system that we use to support our classification and compensation system is very antiquated. In fact, this problem came to notice for us only when we were talking to agency directors and their corresponding HR directors about implementation of the legislative intent of the prior bill. And so we can do some research and I can get back to you with our best estimates, but it's not easy to tell. Because the way we keep information in our classification system is by job title. So I can run you a report that says here are all of the managers in this classification, but I can't necessarily sort out for you how many of those with that classification would be eligible in a professional classification definition. So we can make some estimations by talking with our agency directors, but I don't have an easy report to run for you.
Other questions? Representative Lively.
Excuse me, you probably explained this, but I'm still confused where they fit, where this classification fits within the hierarchy of the other classifications or, you know, within the teams.
Chair Holby, Representative Lively, as I understand it, in the series of positions that are management service. There are three existing. This would create a fourth category that is equal.
Okay, thank you.
So any other questions?
Mr. Chair?
Mr. Richardson?
This is a matter for the committee. I would think that we need to be careful about this because if this was saying we were going to create a new classification, move everyone into it, and then we will evaluate whether or not compensation was appropriate for the various classifications, that's a two-step process. But if this is basically saying we're going to approve as a legislature this new classification, and then DAS will decide what the pay grades are going to be, it may be there could be some unintended consequences that would be a problem. And so I think we ought to be concerned about that.
Chair Hovey, Representative Richardson, I certainly understand your concern. I will do our homework and we'll come back to you with information.
Thanks.
Okay. Great.
Thank you for the time.
One question for me, I guess, and then perhaps the next testifiers will tell us that. So would this potentially have the impact of moving people out of the collective bargaining agreement and into a managerial spot where they are more at-will employees?
Chair Holvey, members of the committee, my understanding is that as it's currently drafted, it has that implication. That was not the intention. Our intention was to use it as a clarification of the management service classification, which is why we've been in dialogue with labor, because they pointed out to us that as drafted, it had that consequence, not our intention, and we're working together with them on language to amend it.
Thank you for that. Appreciate you being here.
My pleasure. Thank you for the grace of bringing a helper.
Even though you didn't need him. up next, we have Stacy Cowan and Mary Botkin.
Let me go first.
Good afternoon. If you would introduce yourself for the record.
Sure. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Stacey Cowan with SEIU Local 503. Thank you for the opportunity to come here and testify today. So we did want an opportunity to just get on the record that as written, we are opposed to the bill. We have had some conversations with DAS, and we're happy to work with them on amending the bill to make sure that we can remove any unintended consequences that are currently written. We definitely appreciate the need for more transparency, but we did want to point out that as it's written, the bill would allow for positions that are currently in classified service to be moved to this new professional service category. Many positions in classified service, both represented and unrepresented, are considered professional. They also require advanced knowledge for the performance of the primary duties of the position. For example, classified service includes economists, physicians, clinical psychologists. For that reason, we would like to see the amendment include more clearly and narrowly defined parameters for this new professional category. Another point is that supervisory, management, confidential are all PECBA, the Public Employees Collective Bargaining Agreement, definitions and categories. The bill as it's written actually changes a different statute. Just as another point, that we actually believe that highly skilled technical workers actually should be a part of the collective bargaining unit if they're not managing other workers. So that's something obviously that we can have a conversation with DAS for. One last note is that we just want to make sure that this legislation and any amendment doesn't subvert the legislature's intentions around House Bill 4131 and House Bill 2020, the 11-to-1 staffing ratio. So that's something that we just want to make sure, again, as isn't an unintended consequence, and we aren't subverting that legislation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Mary Botkin with AFSCME, Council 75, and I share SEIU's concerns about this bill. A couple of things. I guess I don't understand why management services don't fit into the current categories they already have. Probably this is a red letter day because Representative Richardson and I might actually agree on something.
Mm-hmm. And it's happened twice in the last 10 years.
You know, I share his concerns that this is sort of a thinly veiled effort by management to take people out of our bargaining units in our higher classifications and with higher knowledge and move them into a management position where suddenly they're going to miraculously get a huge raise but lose all of their collective bargaining rights. So, you know, we see it sort of as a potential of an erosion of our collective bargaining units. And under PECPA, that would be, under normal conditions, a ULP. But since these people would not have any collective bargaining rights, would not be covered under PECPA because they would be now be under ORS 240 instead of ORS 243, they would lose those rights to have any sort of day in court, so to speak. And so that's a big concern of ours. We share the concerns the SEIU has that this is a way to sort of conceal the requirements of 2020 and the 11-to-1 ratios, which we've been having trouble getting DAS to meet anyway. And, you know, so we don't want to see any more erosion of that effort. And generally speaking, we just don't like this bill as written. I don't have to sit down and talk to DAS. My boss does. Joe Basler gets to do that when he gets back from Washington, D.C. So I want you to see me as Joe Basler today. I am pitch hitting on this bill, but I don't like it. We don't like it. And I understand from Joe that he's more than happy to sit down and see if they can work out the differences.
Thank you. I appreciate that. Other questions? I think we've heard the two sides to this particular bill. No more questions for you. Thank you very much for expressing your opinion on House Bill 2210. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2210. I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2207. Bob, jumping around a little bit again with for you, you know, and I'd like you to give us a little brief summary of this bill, please.
I'm always happy to be kept on my toes, Mr. Chair. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2207 requires state payroll to be issued through direct electronic deposit, requires Department of Administrative Services to issue statements of deductions via electronic mail.
Thank you. And up first, we have Sarah Miller.
Chair, may I have the same grace to bring my helper?
You may.
Thank you.
You're always welcome to bring whatever reinforcement you need.
I appreciate that, Chair Holvey. Thanks. Chair Holvey, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Sarah Miller. I'm the Deputy Chief Operating Officer for State Government. I'm offering testimony today on House Bill 2207. House Bill 2207 was introduced by the Department of Administrative Services to maximize some efficiencies that were identified in the administration of payroll throughout state government. Representative Smith had opportunity to hear me talk about the project that led to this piece of legislation in the Ways and Means Subcommittee this morning. Currently, state employees whose wages are paid through the state payroll system receive payment either by paper check, by direct deposit into a bank account, or in the form of a payroll card, pretty similar to a debit card. DAS statewide payroll prints itemized payroll statements and delivers. Most agencies deliver these statements to employees by hand. The story I was telling in committee this morning is that in my agency, they have to be handed to me individually to be in compliance with my security policies, and it normally takes my assistant about 4 trips to my office to be able to hand me the paper pay stub. In many agencies, they put the pay stubs in envelopes and mail them to people's houses as a way to securely deliver them. And so no matter what, even in places where people have tried to make that process more efficient, it's still a very manual process. House Bill 2207 would require state employees who are paid through the system to receive payment by direct deposit or payment card, eliminating the printing of paper checks, and to receive payroll statements electronically. Fully automating that process and taking the manual piece out, we believe is more efficient and would save time and money. We have an estimate of savings to the tune of about $360,000 a biennia in money and staff time. So that's direct postage envelopes and estimate of staff time for delivery. Current language in the bill as introduced requires employees to provide an email address to receive their payroll statement, because when we were drafting this legislative concept, we thought the technology answer was that we were going to email people their pay stubs. Turns out that it's more secure for us to put a website together to allow people to get their pay stub electronically, not unlike the experience you all have logging into your online bank account. It would be very similar system that would allow you to log on to get your pay stub. And so we would not do a big data conversion of old existing pay stubs. The idea is when the solution is available, the first month pay stub would go on it. We would add each new pay stub until we got to 13 months worth, and then it would be a 13-month rolling clock. In the 14th month, the first month's pay stub would come off, and the 14th month would be available. And so that allows the solution to be sort of technology neutral. You know, I don't know about for you all how frequently you change your email addresses, but lots of people change their email addresses in their personal life often, and so it's much less difficult to administer technically to deliver in a website format. Frankly, there are still some implementation details to work out. My legislative coordinator showed up here just minutes before this hearing to talk about a meeting he'd been in this morning where there were some viable issues raised with the complete elimination in all categories of a paper check. And so we need some time to work with the committee to introduce amendments that make the process most efficient, right? It's not the idea to provide a solution that creates more problems in bureaucracy. We're trying to simplify things. And so we do have a few details to work out from an implementation perspective. But to give you an idea, we issue 36,597 pay stubs. That's the total number of employees that are receiving payment out of the state payroll system. We issue, for that number, about 4,000 printed checks. That's about 11%. And the remainder receive their payments electronically, either by direct deposit or on a Visa card. So about 89% are already getting it electronically. Like I said before, the estimated savings is about $360,000 per biennia. With that, I'm open for any questions.
Questions from the committee? Representative Thatcher.
I know I can't amend the bill how I would like because I saw the relating clause just applies to state payroll, but I would submit that every employer in the state would like the option that you're talking about as far as being able to submit pay stubs, because it's like you're doing the same work that you were when you were doing the paper money, you know, checks and all that. You're doing the same work, and it costs a lot. So throwing that out there, hopefully somebody brilliant can come up with a great bill, but sounds like there might be an amendment anyway that has to do with not requiring everybody to participate. Is that my understanding?
Chair Holvey, Representative Thatcher, there are so many ideas about making this right that I don't feel comfortable speaking to which ones of those are going to be entertained, but certainly your point is well taken. We had members of our subcommittee come up to us afterwards this morning talking about that exact same experience in private sector and what a difference this would make. So maybe it would be a place where Oregon state government could be on the cutting edge of industry and go to the technology that we all expect to have access to in the way we bank, in the way we transact our world. It sort of makes sense that you would also get your payroll information available to you when you want it, not lose the piece of paper between my desk and my house. So.
Representative Doherty.
Just for information, Representative Thatcher is very much of a visionary. We have two bills in business and labor that deal with this in private sector.
I knew somebody brilliant.
Chair Holvey, Representative Doherty, thank you for doing my work.
thank you. I thought she was talking about local government, and I was kind of wondering whether she was taking away local control by
private sector
suggesting that, but maybe not. So other questions? Thank you very much. Sounds like a good endeavor, and look forward to seeing those amendments. With that, we will close the public hearing on House Bill 2207. And we'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2239. Uh,
Bob, would you please give us a summary of the bill, please, of House Bill 2239?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, House Bill 2239 limits the exemption from Oregon mortgage lender law for financial holding company or bank holding company to entities that do no more than control a subsidiary or affiliate and do not engage in the business of a mortgage banker or mortgage broker.
Thank you. We have signed up to testify on this bill, David Tapman.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is David Tapman. I'm the administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities, which is part of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. I believe you received an overview from the department director probably a week ago, talking about what we do there. I will just say, by way of background, our division is charged with the regulation of financial services within the state of Oregon, and that encompasses, among other things, the regulation of banks, credit unions, mortgage lenders, those register and sell securities, as well as a host of other programs around consumer financial products. I'm here today to testify in support of House Bill 2239. It would allow the department to oversee mortgage lending conducted by bank subsidiaries. Just to clarify, the purpose of the bill is to ensure that those subsidiaries, corporate entities, LLCs, partnerships and alike that are not banks and are treated as separate entities would be then subject to regulation as mortgage brokers. We believe this would provide better consumer protection and certainly strengthen the oversight of the mortgage lending activity of these subsidiaries of banks and move to a more even and competitive environment for mortgage lending business. The purpose of the bill is to narrow the exemption as it currently exists right now. It would require the obtaining of a license by these subsidiaries, and it would apply to all banks, federal and state, that choose to do business through a subsidiary in Oregon in terms of mortgage lending. Without going into a great amount of detail, I just want to give you a little background about mortgage lending in general. Mortgage lending requires, as of 1993, when this body passed laws to regulate mortgage lending, that companies that engage in mortgage lending, either mortgage bankers or mortgage brokers, have to become licensed as a mortgage lender. That requires a review of financial statements, requires a surety bond scaled to the amount of lending the organization does, and ensures that they use a mortgage loan originator to provide those mortgage lending services, and they only do so through such an originator. It ensures that we conduct examinations periodically of these entities and that there is an opportunity for consumers who feel aggrieved or wish to inquire further have a place to go and raise those inquiries or have complaints reviewed. If complaints merit enforcement action, we can take action against mortgage lenders through a host of different options, whether it's an administrative action or a civil lawsuit or even occasionally, we will pursue criminal charges against somebody engaged in egregious violations or mortgage fraud. There's also a civil right of action for an aggrieved consumer. In addition, 3 years ago, mortgage loan originators were also subject to becoming licensed. Those are the individuals, if you will, the agents for these companies, and they have to go through an examination process. They have to pass an examination. They have to ensure that they do continuing education. They go through a criminal history background check. We ensure that they meet certain financial responsibilities, and we ensure that they are supervised by their mortgage lender directly. At the adoption of the mortgage lending law in 1993, certain exemptions were created. Some of them are going to be fairly obvious. Attorneys are exempt from having to become licensed as a mortgage broker. Agents of the federal government are exempt, as well as those who invest in mortgage loans for their own personal investment. The one exemption we're talking about today, though, is the one that would provide an exemption for subsidiaries and affiliates of banks, both state and federal, provided that they're subject to the oversight of a bank regulator. Now, the exemption came into existence in 1993 in part because there was a perception that federal preemption prohibited the states from taking any action against federal banks. Not state banks, but just federal banks. And under that perception and the understanding of the preemption laws at that time, Oregon created this exemption to all banks, not just to the federal banks, so there would be an even playing field among the banks. And this exemption extends to any subsidiary in which a majority of it is owned by a bank or bank holding company. As it stands right now, oversight of these subsidiaries is rolled up into a bank examination by the supervising authority, whether it's a state chartering, the state has chartered the bank, therefore a state regulator would oversee it, or whether the feds have chartered it, and then the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, or the OCC to most of us, which is a subsidiary of the Treasury, would oversee that. Now, the OCC is what's known as a prudential regulator, and that means that they engage in an oversight of banks and the banking enterprise as a whole to ensure the safety and soundness of the banking programs, both individual programs and the operation of banking in the United States. With that charge, the OCC has chartered over 2,000 banks currently under its supervision, and those banks hold over $9 trillion in assets. These banks own numerous subsidiaries that engage in a number of activities, including mortgage lending, and some of it involves residential mortgage lending here in Oregon. As you can see, it's a massive operation that the OCC oversees on behalf of the U.S. government. The sheer size of the OCC's charge and responsibility and its focus on the big picture of safety and soundness means that these subsidiaries, especially once removed from the banks, are less likely to receive the same scrutiny as the parent banks themselves. So you can imagine the degree of scrutiny that a mortgage lending activity done by an organization either in Oregon or licensed or doing business with an Oregonian is fairly limited. And this has created what we are calling a regulatory gap. And we can see that regulatory gap by this example. Since 2009, the department has received a little over 700 complaints about financial institutions. And when I say financial institutions, we're talking about banks, both national and state. 400 plus of those complaints were related to mortgage lending, mortgage servicing, and foreclosure activities. Of those 411 complaints, 373, or 91% of those complaints, involved a federal chartered institution or subsidiary. So it's a large number of complaints focused on these federal institutions. The complaints we received were usually given to us in the name of the parent corporation or the holding company, so we were unable to make an exact determination whether a subsidiary was involved or whether it was the bank itself was. But based on our best estimate of looking at some of the names we received, we took an estimation that about 20% of those 373 complaints, or 75 of those complaints, involved organizations that were subsidiaries.
Mm-hmm. So the excuse me, Mr. Chairman, can you repeat that figure for us?
What percent? 75%?
Of the 373 complaints we received involving mortgage lending by a federal chartered institution, our best estimate is 76, or 20% of the complaints, involved subsidiaries. So when a federal institution or its subsidiary is the subject of a complaint, the only option we have for Oregonians is to tell them to refer it to the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency, and that complaint or referral is then sent to a call center in Fort Worth, Texas, where all complaints are handled by the Office of the Comptroller of the Currency. Now, we've seen the ebb and flow of mortgage lending over the last 20 years,
Correct.
And we've seen a number of times when the mortgage lenders, those that are licensed by us, engage in a large amount of the lending, and then we see times where the banks engage, that is, the depository banks engage in most of the lending. Right now, according to the Portland Business Journal, the four largest national banks hold 42% of the residential mortgage marketing in the United States. And that's compared to 29% 6 years ago. So that's the ebb. But we anticipate that the market's going to heat up again. And we expect to see more lending activity. And we want to be in a position to ensure that when this happens, Oregonians will have the opportunity to receive the best service they're entitled to, and the businesses are responsive to Oregonian complaints and direct supervision by us. Congress, as you've already heard, in great part due to the economic damage that was done by an open throttle mortgage lending practices of the first decade of the 20th century, 21st century, the 2000s, passed the Dodd-Frank Act. The Act recognized the need for the states to be more active and play a greater role in the oversight of mortgage lending, and it loosened the Act loosened some of the federal preemption that I was talking about earlier in terms of state regulation of subsidiary activity. The states are now free to decide what level of oversight they want to give to the activity of bank subsidiaries, both state and federal. Prompted by this shift in federal law, states are beginning to adopt either changes in their laws, or certain states had never taken the effort to address the preemption piece, and they're now applying the law that has always been on their books. According to the Conference of State Bank Supervisors, 26 states say they now require licensing for mortgage lending subsidiaries. So our concept is obviously not the first out of the box, but in fact reflects where the states intend to go. I'd like to just point out that the bill does not remove the other exemptions I mentioned earlier. So entities already licensed and examined by our department under different statutory schemes, for instance, consumer finance licensees, and the banks themselves could still operate without an additional license. In addition, the bill clarifies that financial institution holding companies, or bank holding companies, as we most of us know them as, would remain exempt from having to be licensed. And finally, I think it's worth noting that credit unions that choose to use a subsidiary or a third party to engage in residential mortgage lending through a credit union service organization, or what's commonly known as a CUSO, they're already required to get licensed as mortgage lenders. There is no such exclusion or exemption for them. So this would not change the practices for credit unions. In conclusion, I'll say we've talked to a number of groups. We've gotten somewhat of a mixed response, but a number of the mortgage lenders themselves are supportive of this, as a number of public groups are. I believe the committee either has or will receive written testimony from other groups. And at this point, I would just ask for your support for the bill, and I would stand ready to answer the questions to the best of my ability.
So, I have a quick question out of the box. I think it's an obvious question, but I want to ask it anyway. On page 3 of the bill, I think it's line 17, where you have deleted the references to the savings and loan holding companies and the subsidiaries mm-hmm. under that, and more subsidiaries under that. Are those being deleted because they're basically defined in the new language above?
Mr. Chair, so if you go to page 3, capital B, starting at line 12, we talk about the financial holding company and the bank holding companies. They do not lose their exemption. But what we're talking about is if it's a subsidiary of a bank or financial holding company, this is where we would remove that exemption and require the licensing. So it's not the entity, it's the one-off down below. In terms of line 17, the savings and loan holding company goes away because they don't exist anymore. That's when the feds took that over recently under the Dodd-Frank Act and did away with savings and loan holding companies or federal thrift companies, and now they're all under the OCC again.
That answers my question. Okay, Representative Smith.
Thank you, Chair Holby. I'm trying to get my arms around how big of an issue we're dealing with here. If I heard you correctly, there were 76 complaints towards subsidiaries or affiliates of banks. How does that compare with the total number of mortgages that were closed by subsidiary or affiliates?
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, I don't have that answer. I don't know how many these national banks in particular, how many mortgages they'll close. I assume we could find that on a website, but it's not a report that we would routinely receive. But
is it 10% or 20% or less than 1%?
I don't even want to hazard a guess, Representative Smith. I don't know, but we're just looking at the number of complaints that we get, and that's where the 20% came from that I provided earlier. And again, that's only the complaints that came to us as opposed to complaints that may have gone to the Department of Justice or directly to the OCC or to other states. So I couldn't put that into context, and that's why we're hesitant to say this percentage is rock solid. This is just a best guesstimate.
Just a follow-up question. So with the complaints, we're going to have a new hotline, I assume, or some mechanism in which folks can report. What will be the follow-up that will follow the complaint? How is your agency going to handle that process?
Mr. Chair and Representative Smith, I'm happy to answer that. We believe this is something we can absorb with our current staffing. We don't believe the numbers are going to be a dramatic shift at this time. Should we find that we are wrong and there's hundreds and hundreds of companies, which we don't believe is the case, as I said, we can address that. But right now, we have a very robust process by which all consumer complaints in writing, by phone, or over the email are responded to within an acknowledgement period of time of 36 hours. And then we will follow up and send out a request from to the company that's being complained of to get an explanation of or some better understanding of the complaint and make a determination if, in fact, there has been something we would deem a violation. So that's a process that we're able to do within the first 30 days or so, and I don't think that's going to change. I believe we can put that right into our system. The question would become, what happens if we're finding lots of actual violations that require additional work? I think we can absorb that as well. My hope and belief is that we won't see a lot of additional enforcement work. A lot of times companies, when you point out they've made a mistake, they want to do the right thing and they'll correct it themselves. So I think we're there to just provide a voice to the consumer, and oftentimes one call or letter could take care of the problem.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
You bet. Any other questions?
Mr. Chair.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Pursuant to the good representative's questions, too, I guess I'm still trying to wrap my mind around how large of an issue this is. You know, we talk about subsidiaries, but do you have a guess on how many we're actually talking about that could be the bad apples or the folks that are leading to those 70-some-odd complaints that you're referencing?
Yeah, Mr. Chair and Representative.
Is there a way to get more specific, I guess, is what I'm saying?
Yes, Mr. Chair, Representative Johnson, I use the right word, best guess. What we have done is we've done an analysis. We've contacted our organization back in Washington, D.C., the Conference of State Bank Supervisors and alike, and what we believe is, we know for sure there are five different entities doing business in the state of Oregon that would constitute subsidiaries, and each one of those has a branch that is engaged in doing business, and so there are approximately, like, I'm going to have to give you an approximation. Of those five entities, there are 29 different branches or subsidiaries engaged in this activity, so they have 29 loan originators. Those we're aware of. Based on our best guesstimate, we believe that there may be somewhere between, I'd say roughly 20 to 25 such subsidiaries, and it looks like each subsidiary licenses one person. So we're talking possibly 20. I've talked to my program manager in this program. She believes that that's maybe an underestimation because of the lack of information that the states get about these subsidiaries, and there may be information that just goes straight to the feds in terms of complaints and the like. If you want a rough ballpark, I'm thinking maybe 25 to 30 companies.
Okay. Follow up. What would be your, okay, let's just say the legislation passes and so forth. What's your process for then reaching out to communicate with the industry to let them know about these new stipulations, regulations, and what would be the penalties or the for not complying with the licensure and so forth? What kind of penalties do you have in mind for them?
Mr. Chair and Representative Johnson, our hope is there wouldn't be a penalty. I can give you an example. We just went through a similar process with our investment advisors. The law changed for investment advisors, and those are the people that provide securities investment advice for a fee. And the law changed in terms of what the feds covered and what the states covered, and that change resulted in somewhere in the ballpark of, I believe, 50 to 60 new investment advisors coming under our direct jurisdiction. We rolled out a whole campaign from something as simple as letter writing to our website to telephone calls, and we gave them a period of 9 months to do this, and we kept putting them on notice and making sure that they were aware of that. As a result, we didn't have to take any action against any of these. I believe these institutions, these subsidiaries who are part of a banking institution, are going to be much more aware of it than a small investment advisory shop, and the word would go out. I've talked to my counterpart in Arizona, who's recently done this. They've had absolutely no problem with this whatsoever. So I don't believe that's going to be, if you will, a trap for the unwary or a tripwire for people. Our goal is not one. We don't see this as an opportunity to make a lot of money or expand our empire, nor are we looking to take action. Our goal is to make sure these people are under our direct supervision, and we have an opportunity to examine them, make sure they're in compliance with Oregon law, and there's a place for consumers to get relief if they need it.
Representative Thatcher.
Just real quickly, I don't think you're talking about this, but I just want to make sure that you're not talking about the places that says owner will carry, where they're going to offer financing to whoever purchases their property. You're not talking about that, correct?
Mr. Chair, Representative Thatcher, absolutely correct.
Okay, thank you.
We're not touching that.
Any other questions? Mr. Tatman, thank you for your very thorough description of this bill. I appreciate your time, and I'm certain we'll probably take action on this in the future.
Thank you. I'll remain here if there's any follow-up you need for the next couple minutes.
Thank you. With that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2239, and I'm going to move back on the agenda and open up our work session on House Bill 2531.
Okay. Chair Hovey, I move House Bill 2531 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Lively moves House Bill 2531 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any discussion? We do have a fiscal impact statement that Bob is handing out right now. And we'll give the committee a few minutes to look that over since it just got handed out. Had anticipated having the appraisal board here, but it doesn't appear that they are here. If there was any questions to that.
It's interesting they have no oversight by the executive or legislative branch.
That's very similar to many of our boards and commissions, Representative Richardson. A topic that I'm sure we could talk for hours on.
So any other questions or answers? I think the testifier on this did indicate that, you know, she didn't see a large number of companies that would be impacted by this change in the legislation, so.
Yes. Mr. Chair.
Yes, Representative Smith.
You know, it's interesting. I work regularly with these type of companies, and I don't see where there's any issue with this legislation. To me, it makes sense.
Yeah, it's basically conforming to the federal guidelines and rules and laws, I guess you should call them, that have been changing rather rapidly over the last few years. And so seeing no further discussion, Samantha, can we have a roll call vote, please?
Representative Vega Peterson.
Aye.
Representative Thatcher.
Aye.
Representative Smith.
Aye.
Representative Penny Geyer.
Aye.
Representative Johnson.
Aye.
Representative Doherty.
Aye.
Vice Chair Richardson.
Aye.
Vice Chair Lifford.
Aye.
Chair Holby.
Aye. House Bill 2531, having received the votes, has declared passed. And do we have a volunteer to carry this rather simple bill? Representative Smith, oh, thank you.
You bet, Mr. Chair. Please do.
With that, I will close the work session on House Bill 2531. And committee, Mr. Administrator, anything else on our agenda today? I don't believe so. Oh yes. For the record, you know, do check your OLIS for testimony from the Oregon Law Center and John McCauley from the Oregon Association of Mortgage Professionals on House Bill 2239, and we will be carrying over House Bill 2143 till Thursday. And with that, I will adjourn the House Committee on Consumer Protection and Government Efficiency.